The issue of finances is often a rather touchy subject. Nations have to deal with disagreements over finances, disagreements over money. Should there be property taxes, value-added taxes, sales taxes, excise taxes, user fees, income tax, flat tax, graduated percentages, tolls, and or a combination of all of them, as it seems it often is. How should that money be spent? What portion should be used for infrastructure? What part to be used for public safety? What about retirement funds? What about helping the needy? What about other social programs? You know, these types of issues are the things that have led to long, deep, divisive arguments in governments. Families have to deal with issues over handling finances as well. Andrea Coombs, in an article in the April 12, 2015 issue of Wall Street Journal, made this statement: money is one of the biggest sources of marital discord, and it can be one of the toughest to resolve. And she goes on to explain that part of the reason for that is that sometimes how you handle money isn't so much about that particular issue at that particular time, but it also involves some of our inner fears and worries and concerns and about finances in general. And then there are questions about household money. Should we pool it all? Should each member put a certain percentage toward household bills and keep the rest as personal funds if they're both working? Or does everybody keep their own? And they just kind of, some pays one bill, some pays another. Do you pool them? Who handles the checkbook? Who actually writes the check? Who decides what checks to write? All kinds of issues that come up. As some have said about a number of issues, reasonable people can disagree on these issues and how best to handle it. The sad thing is that when someone begins to impute evil motives towards someone else, that's when things get really difficult. Well, you want more of the money for public safety because you don't care about the poor and the needy. You know, you start imputing motives to people that's really when it gets kind of nasty. Or you want separate checking accounts because you want to hide your true income from me, if we're getting to a family issue. I mean, that's a pretty ugly situation to see. When you think about finances and the kind of issues and the problems that can come as a result of money and material things, it's no wonder God says so much about money and about possessions in the Bible. I was looking at a couple of different sites. There's an article on preachingtoday.com that makes this statement. It says 16 of the 38 parables were concerned with how to handle money and possessions. Of course, the parables meaning the ones that Jesus gave while he was here in the flesh. In the Gospels, continuing, it says, in the Gospels, an amazing 1 out of 10 verses, 288 in all, deal directly with the subject of money. The Bible offers 500 verses on prayer, 500 verses on faith, but more than 2,000 verses on money and possessions. I found that kind of interesting. I didn't realize it was quite that disparity. That's from preachingtoday.com. Now, we can't cover all those verses and principles, and I don't plan to today, but what I'd like to talk about is one principle of finances that God teaches us in his Word, and that's tithing. In one sense, it seems like, well, that's kind of a straightforward thing, isn't it? I mean, if you look at the word tithe, it just simply means tenth. It means you owe 10% to God, 10% of your income. Well, that's true, but I'd like to look at some points about tithing today. Talk about a few things and cover some of this topic today. One point that's almost universally agreed by people who believe in God is that God expects us, he expects his people to give back something to him for his blessings, for what he gives to us as human beings. Let's go to Psalm 24, take a look at a statement here. Psalm 24, this is a psalm of David. In verse 1, and we find that David gives us this perspective about God as the one who claims everything that exists. Because it really is all his. He created everything. Psalm 24, verse 1, the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. Not part of what's here on the earth. All its fullness. The world and those who dwell therein. So God claims really everything. It all belongs to Him. We belong to Him. Animals belong to Him. Whatever we have belongs to Him. I mean, all the birds, all the mammals and fishes, everything that's around, everything belongs to God, including us, our own lives. Later in Psalm 50, I'm not going to turn there, but Asaph says God talks about the cattle on 1,000 hills and the birds and beasts all being His. Now, we may have a bill of sale that keeps other human beings from claiming certain possessions, but in the long run, God says it all belongs to me anyway. I allow you to use it. I give you the use of it. But ultimately, it belongs to me. I remember reading an article, a summary, several years ago in a publication called Current Thoughts and Trends. And here's what one author had to say about the 7 points he made in his article about tithing. He said, the tithe is God's tax for living on the earth. Oh, man, we're into taxes again. You know, can't we get off of taxes? But it's kind of an interesting way of looking at it. It's God's tax for us living on this planet. Look, you live on that planet. Planet's mine. So I want 10%. But it's not 10% of everything we own. It's 10% of the increase. So in that sense, he's saying just whatever you increase, I want 10% of that. He goes on to say, recognizing God as sovereign, we have to be careful to acknowledge His graceful provision. Tithing is one mandated way of doing this. You know, God has the right to claim a part of our increase. He even cautioned Israel to not think too highly of themselves when they did have increase, when they did have a profit, when they turned a profit, when they had an increase in their possessions. Notice this in Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy, of course, is the time period, or covers that time period, just before they got into the promised land. Deuteronomy chapter 18. Let's see, skip down to verse 14. He says, for the nations which you will dispossess, listen to soothsayers and diviners, but as for you, the Lord has not appointed such to you. Whoops, wait a minute, I think I've got the wrong verse here. It's the one that, this was the one verse I didn't look at in my notes. It's the one where he talks about thinking it was your hand that... Let me back up here. Well, wouldn't you know it? It's the one that I didn't check. But I'm looking for the one where he said that it's not your hand that has created all these blessings that to gain wealth, that God is the one who gives us the ability to gain wealth. Nobody can help me out here. Nobody. Is it Deuteronomy 6? Is that the one I'm looking for? Where it talks about teaching your children. Well, my eye doesn't fall on it. I'm sorry about that. But there is a statement he makes that you realize that it's not us that creates. It's God who gives us the ability to gain wealth. It's God who gives us the ability. 8:18. Somebody's telling me it's 8:18, and that's exactly right. So why was there an 18 instead of an 8? Fingers just get going too fast sometimes. Thank you. Appreciate that. It is chapter 8, Deuteronomy chapter 8. We can start a little bit before that. He says, when you multiply your herds, when things go well for you, verse 13, your herds and flocks multiply, your silver and your gold are multiplied, everything that you have is multiplied. In other words, you gain increase. All things are going well. He said, don't forget, verse 14, your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. And he skips down, we can skip down through this. He talks about all that he did for them. In verse 18, he says, and you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as it is to this day. So the right perspective is to realize God owns it all anyway. And even those things that increase, it's God gives us that ability. He gives us the wisdom, or he gives us the insight, or he gives us the blessings. Sets us in the right place to be able to have an increase or to have a gain. So God is the one who gives us that ability. Now, one claim people make today sometimes about tithing is that it wasn't in effect before Moses and the children of Israel came to Mount Sinai. That it was there when God established the old covenant. And since we no longer live under the old covenant, therefore tithing is no longer necessary. In the New Testament, many people say, well, God just wants you to give what you can. Just give whatever you decide to. Now, in one sense, it's not hard to refute that argument, at least if we're willing to look at the Bible and take it at its word. Genesis chapter 14 is one place we often go. Genesis 14 is long, long, long before Mount Sinai. It does involve Abraham, who was the father and the great-great-great-great-grandfather of the children of Israel. But in Genesis chapter 14, we find that his nephew Lot, Abraham's nephew, was taken captive, and Abraham took his men and went after the captors and brought back everyone who had been captured. Verse 16 talks about that. He brought back their goods, also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. In verse 17, the king of Sodom went out to meet him, and after his return. In verse 18, let's pick it up there in verse 18 and read this. It says, then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God Most High. And he blessed him. That means Melchizedek blessed him, Abraham. Melchizedek blessed Abraham and said, blessed be Abraham of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. Obviously, God is a possessor. Abram was blessed of God. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he gave him a tithe of all. Now, the he and him aren't identified, but it's very clear that Melchizedek was the priest and Abram was the servant of God, or servant of the priest. And Abram is the one who is giving a tithe. So, several interesting points. Melchizedek is identified further in Hebrews. We'll talk about that a little bit later in Hebrews 7. Bread and wine is mentioned. I've often thought that was interesting. Maybe that's just a victory celebration. Maybe there are some overtones of the symbols of Passover. God doesn't explain. But bread and wine were involved in this. And God possesses everything. We've already seen that. Abraham tithes. Again, we'll come back to Hebrews 7 when we'll talk about that a little bit later, that Abram gave a tithe of the spoils, the things that they gained. It's interesting, some people I have heard argue in various Church of God groups that, well, if it's not agricultural, you don't have to tithe on it. We'll talk about that again a little bit later. But obviously these spoils would have included clothing, would have included silver, weapons, food, tents, household items, all of that. Won't go through the example of Jacob, which was also before Mount Sinai, but Jacob in Genesis 28 talks about God protecting him, and that if God does, he will tithe. So he knew about tithing, and he knew that he needed to tithe. He knew that he should tithe. And he said, God, I'll do this if you will help me out. So these are just a few examples, just talking about them very briefly, about tithing already being in effect before Mount Sinai. Just as the Sabbath was created at creation long before Mount Sinai, so tithing was in effect long before Mount Sinai. Now, why does that matter, you might ask? Well, actually, it is very, very important, because most of Christianity believes that once Christ died and the old covenant is no longer what we're under, then tithing goes away. They feel that it disappears at the start of the New Testament church. But if tithing didn't start at Mount Sinai, it can't be done away with. It can't end with the old covenant. So it is very important to recognize that tithing was in effect long before the old covenant began. I do think it's helpful in this kind of an overview doctrinal message to take a moment to look at what was done under the Levitical priesthood. If we look at what was done there, we can pick up a number of points from just a couple of passages. We'll look at one in Leviticus, and then we'll look at one in Numbers. So let's look first at Leviticus 27, Leviticus chapter 27. This is the last chapter of the book of Leviticus. And we will start in verse 30. Notice there are a number of things of monetary, financial aspects that are covered throughout this whole chapter. But the part that talks about tithing really begins in verse 30. So let's pick it up there as a topic for today. Leviticus chapter 27, verse 30. It says, "And all the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord." And as I said, there are some people who want to take this verse and say, this is the only instruction about tithing, isolate it, and say, see, it says seed or tree. So if it's agricultural, then it belongs to God, the tithe does. Now we'll address that again in a little bit. "If a man wants at all to redeem any of his tithes, he shall add one-fifth to it. And concerning the tithe of the herd of the flock, of whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. He shall not inquire whether it's good or bad, nor shall he exchange it. And if he exchanges it at all, then both it and the one exchanged for it shall be holy. It shall not be redeemed. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the children of Israel on Mount Sinai." So there are some principles that are brought out in this passage. And while these were designed for the Old Testament and specifically for the nation of Israel, they are principles that are still valuable today. Number one, God owns the tithe. The tithe belongs to him. Even though God allowed Levi to use the tithes, and he told ancient Israel that's who they were to tithe to, it's God's tithe. It belongs to God. He says, it is holy, it is the Lord's, it is holy to the Lord. That's an important point to realize. It's not ultimately the Levites' tithe. It's God's tithe. In the Old Testament, they were to give it to Levi, but God changes that. We see that it was God's tithe. In fact, God claimed in the book of Malachi that Israel had broken the eighth commandment by stealing from him. Secondly, we note from this passage that seed and fruit are tithed on. They can be redeemed by adding another fifth part, or 20%. Why would that be important? Well, the reason would probably be, as best we can tell, high-quality seed. If you had a high-quality seed or fruit and you wanted to keep that because you thought that would produce or that would increase the value of next year's crop, well, you could take that seed that was the 10%, and you could say, that's really good. I want to hang on to that. And God says, okay, if you do that, then you have to give the same amount plus 20% to pay your tithe. But you can keep that in terms of seed or fruit. Now, when it comes to a flock, that wasn't allowed. When it comes to an animal, God says, no, no. If you want to redeem that animal, not only do you lose that animal, you lose the one that you tried to swap for it. In other words, you give them both as tithe. You can't change the animal. And the passing under the rod, from what we understand, that was the way they counted the animals. That's the way they tied them. They would go through a chute of some kind, and you would count off animals, and the tenth animal, that was God's. What if you only had nine that were the increase? God says, okay, you keep the nine. It's the tenth animal that God wanted. And whether that animal was the prize animal out of the herd that just happened to get funneled into the chute and was the tenth one, that's the one God gets. If it was the mangiest, sickliest animal of all, that's God's animal. It was simply you count off the tenth, and whatever the tenth one is, you don't exchange it, that's God's tithe. Interesting perspective, isn't it? God says, I want to see you succeed, so if you have less than 10, it's okay, you just keep all the animals. Maybe next year there'll be 10. Maybe next year there'll be 20. Maybe 30. Seems God was very concerned about fairness in that. You know, an unscrupulous herdsman could give God the weak and the lame animals. God said, not going to accept that. If you try to line things up and you try to game the system, you're in trouble. And God doesn't either even require partial animals. So interesting to see what we learn from God and God's perspective by reading this passage. Let's look at another one in Numbers. Numbers chapter 18. And here in the book of Numbers, God is speaking to Aaron in verse 1. It says, "Then the Lord said to Aaron, 'You and your sons and your father's house with you shall bear the iniquity related to the sanctuary.'" In other words, iniquity means guilt or responsibility for the sanctuary. "And you and your sons with you shall bear the iniquity associated with your priesthood. Also bring with your brethren the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may be joined with you and serve you while you and your sons are with you before the tabernacle of witness." So God is giving the Levites to Aaron as servants to him and his family. Skip down to verse 7. Don't need to read the whole chapter, but in verse 7, it says, "Therefore you and your sons with you shall attend to your priesthood for everything at the altar and behind the veil. And you shall serve. I will give your priesthood to you as a gift for service. But the outsider who comes near shall be put to death." So it was only the priests who were to provide that kind of service in the tabernacle. Again, skip down in the chapter, down to verse 20. "Then the Lord said to Aaron, 'You shall have no inheritance in the land, nor shall you have any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the children of Israel. Behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work which they perform, the work of the tabernacle of meeting.'" So here we see several things. Moses and Aaron both were Levites. They were both from the tribe of Levi. I'm not going to go back to Exodus 1 and Exodus 4 to point that out, but they were of the tribe of Levi. Aaron, out of that tribe, God chose the family of Aaron to be the priests. Only one family was given that job. The Levites were there to assist the priest. The Levites, all of the rest of the Levites, that was a job God gave them. They were to serve Aaron and his sons. We saw that in verse 2. The offerings, the holy things, they were given to the priests. I didn't read 8 through 19, but if you go back and read those verses, it talks about offerings. It talks about portions of offerings that were given. All of that went to the priesthood. The Levites, though, got the tithes from the people. They were to be tithe to the Levites, were given the tithes. Notice it says all the tithes went to the Levites. Again, I didn't read verses 26 and 28 through 28, but those show that the Levites in turn tithed of what they were given to Aaron, to the priesthood. So the tithes of the nation went to the Levites. The tithe of what the Levites received went to the priesthood, to Aaron and the priesthood. At no point does God say he relinquishes ownership of those. They still belong to him. But he's given them. He says, "I give them to you to use." So God owns them, just as we said a while ago. He just gave them to Levi in return for the service that they gave him. So, again, why point this out? Why take the time to look at what happened in the Old Testament? Well, tithing began before Mount Sinai, began before the Levites were established, began before Aaron, the Aaronic priesthood. And in the Old Testament, God simply gave the tribe of Levi the use of the tithes for their service in the Old Testament tabernacle and for their service to Aaron and the priesthood. That's a very important point, and one that's often very cloudy and obscured for much of mainstream Christianity, who believe that tithing came into existence with Mount Sinai. We've even had people comment on our websites. I see many of the comments that people make on our websites that pass through my email. My wife keeps telling me you need to simplify, get rid of some of those notifications. But it's interesting to see. There was one a couple of months ago where somebody took exception to our statement on tithing. Said, "Oh, no, in the New Testament, God just wants us to give whatever our heart desires, whatever amount we desire." And, of course, that was answered and responded to. It's not what we see in Scripture. And yet that's what many, many, many people believe. Tithing is still in force. It's God's way of financing his work. And that points out the need to look at the New Testament. So let's take a look at some New Testament passages. Now, first of all, Matthew 23, verse 23. Many of us are very familiar with this verse. It was a statement of condemnation, actually, that Jesus made toward the Pharisees. The Pharisees were in a position of responsibility in the early or in the first century, and the Jewish or in Judaism, I guess would be the way to say it. But they had a number of problems, and Jesus pointed out quite a few of those. Here in verse 23, Matthew 23:23, it says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin." Now, those were all very small items, seeds or leaves, and they would count them out, and they would make sure that they didn't pay too much or didn't pay too little, that it was exactly a tenth. He said, you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. There were bigger issues that they were ignoring, but they focused on the little minutia. Now, it's not that minutia is not important. Important minutia is important. We have a lot of minutia that isn't important in our lives, don't we? I mean, there is a lot of stuff going on, as you saw in the video of Mr. Johnson. We're all trying to do four things at once. Boy, can I relate to that. And probably you can as well. You know, we're all trying to go so many different directions at once. Some of that minutia really isn't important. Some is. He was not saying tithing is not important, because look at the last part of this verse. He says, these things you ought to have done, that is, law, justice, mercy, faith, without leaving the others undone. Some people will look at this verse and say, well, see, it doesn't matter about tithes, as long as you have mercy, as long as you have love, as long as you have faith, as long as you have... I mean, that's not what he said. That's twisting the words of Christ. Yes, the big picture is important. Yes, the big issues are important. But he said those little ones should be done too. Those are important also, because they show ultimately what's in our heart, whether we're going to do those things or not. So Christ is upholding. He's not doing away with tithing here. He's upholding tithing. These ought you have done without leaving the other undone. It's not either or, it's both. Both are important, he says. So it's important that we notice that and take note of it. We see in the book of Hebrews that Jesus didn't abolish the priesthood, but in the new covenant, he changed the priesthood. We saw all the way back in Genesis 14 about, let's go ahead and go to Hebrews. We were talking about that earlier about Melchizedek. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 9. We see that in the new covenant, Jesus replaced the physical priesthood with a spiritual priesthood, the priesthood of him. He is the high priest in the new covenant. Hebrews chapter 9, we can pick it up in verse 8. Again, there's a lot leading up to this, but let's just pick it up in Hebrews 9 and verse 8. It says, the Holy Spirit indicating this, that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest while the first tabernacle was still standing. Remember we read that no one else was to do the service within the veil or in the actual temple. That was only the Aaron and his family. That was a priesthood only. Anyone else that came in, the penalty was death for doing that. So the way into that holy of holies, the holiest of all, wasn't yet available. It is now for us. He says in verse 9, it was, meaning that old covenant approach in the tabernacle, it was symbolic for the present time in which both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regard to the conscience. Concerning only the foods and drinks and various washings and fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of Reformation. But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is not of this creation. Nor with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood he entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. So everything in that old covenant tabernacle, all of those rituals concerning animals and washings and those ordinances, they were all symbolic of what Jesus Christ was going to do. He was going to open the way for all of us into the Holy of Holies. And it wasn't with the blood of bulls and goats, it's with his own precious blood that he died to make that way available for us. But notice it says he came as high priest. He is our high priest in the New Testament. In chapter 7, we'll see that it specifically says he is a high priest of the order of Melchizedek, not Aaron. So go back to chapter 7 with me. Hebrews chapter 7. This chapter begins talking about Melchizedek, who was without father, without mother, verse 3 says. So he had neither beginning of days or end of life. He was eternal and is eternal. He did not, he was a God being, obviously. But skip down to let's pick it up in verse 8. This is Hebrews. Well, actually, no, let's start in verse 5. Hebrews 7, verse 5. He says, "And indeed, those who were of the sons of Levi, who received the priesthood," that would have been the family of Aaron, the Aaronic priesthood, "have a commandment to receive tithes from the people according to the law," that is, from their brethren, "though they have come from the loins of Abraham." I'm sorry, that reference was to Levi in that family. The Levites had the commandment to take the tithes. "But he whose genealogy is not derived from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises." So we see here that Melchizedek is the one that received the tithes from Abraham. Melchizedek is the one who offered the blessing to Abram. Verse 7, "Now beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the better." Here, mortal men, meaning in the Old Testament and actually still taking place at the time of Jesus Christ being here on the earth. Here mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them of whom it is witnessed that he lives. Even Levi, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, so to speak, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Therefore, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there be for another priest, that another priest should arise to the order of Melchizedek and not be called according to the order of Aaron? For the priesthood being changed of necessity, there is also a change of the law. So the discussion from the beginning of the chapter has to do with who receives the tithes. Levi, the Levites in the Old Covenant, and Aaron, in a sense, paid tithes to Melchizedek, since their predecessor, Abraham or Abram, paid tithes to Melchizedek. So they, in that sense, were subservient. So the change in the law of tithing is to revert back to the Melchizedek priesthood again, as it was before Levi was born. Goes back to what God had done prior to the Old Covenant. And we see in the New Testament that Paul plainly stated that as a minister of Jesus Christ, he had the right to be supported by tithes of God's people for his living expenses. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. I know we can get bogged down in Hebrews, so I don't want to spend a whole lot of time there, but simply to point out that the change that he's talking about is the tithing, that having gone first of all to Melchizedek, then to the Levites, it is now reverting back to a Melchizedek priesthood, Jesus Christ being that high priest. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, where do we break into this? We always break into Paul's thoughts, don't we? Should we go back to chapter 1, verse? No, I won't do that. No, we won't go that far. Here we go. Let's do the verse 3. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 3. "My defense to those who examine me is this." In other words, this sort of starts Paul's discussion. "Look, people are attacking me," Paul said, "as a minister. They're claiming I don't have the rights of other ministers. So here's my defense." Verse 4, he says, do we have no right to eat and drink? Obviously, he had the right to eat and drink. You don't eat and drink, you die, right? So he's not talking about in the sense that he was refused the ability to eat and drink. We'll see as we go a little further on, he's saying he had the right to do that at the expense of the church. That he had a right to do that. "Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do also the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord, and Peter? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working?" So here he gets to the point. Is it just the two of us that we don't have that right? That isn't something that God would expect from us or to be given for us or to us? Verse 7, whoever goes to war at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard that does not eat of its fruit? Or who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock? Do I say these things as a mere man, or does not the law say the same also? And here he reverts back to the principles of the Old Testament law, the Old Covenant law. Verse 9, for it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. The animal was to walk around and step on the grain to separate it from the husk. And he said, if the ox is hungry, let him eat. Don't muzzle him where he can't eat. When he's walking around, he's doing labor for you. If he wants a bite of grain, let him have a bite of grain. Don't muzzle him. Give him the right to eat. And Paul adds a statement at the end of verse 9, is it oxen God is concerned about? I mean, when you think about the principle of this, he says, is it only animals God cares about? Or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written. That he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? If others are partaker of this right over you, are we not even more? Nevertheless, we have not used this right, but endured all things, lest we hinder the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who minister the holy things eat of the things of the temple, and those who serve at the altar partake of the offerings of the altar? Even so the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. So he's saying there were others who were doing this. Is it only Barnabas and I that don't have the right to receive the support of the church? Now, in that day, it seems to have been a little more localized in terms of getting the support. But Paul is pretty strong in upholding his right to live from the proceeds of the gospel for his work of preaching the gospel, preaching the truth of God. He's pretty adamant about this. He had that right even if he didn't charge the Corinthian church. So if we take an obvious objective look at this passage, what do we learn from it? Well, there are probably a lot of points. I've got 4 points that I think become clear in my mind. Number one, he had the right from God to be supported for preaching the gospel. He was doing God's work. It's what Jesus told the church to do, what he told the disciples to do. And it's the ministry that has that responsibility to do it. The principle about not muzzling an ox, he says, is written for us. It's really that principle is for us. It applies to us as New Testament Christians. So I guess he's calling me an ox. Okay, I guess I could be called worse. It's all right. It is what it is. At least it's not a donkey like Balaam. Don't give you any ideas, right? He uses analogies. So it's an analogy of an ox. Okay, it's fine. He says those sowing spiritual seed should eat. They should live from the physical things. That's God's command, he says here in verse 14. And I know we get into material things. We get into possessions. We get into money and finances. And that makes some people uncomfortable. But it is what God has established. I won't turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, but the very next letter that he wrote to this troubled congregation. I mean, people have read Corinthians, and many scholars have said, this is the most corrective book in the whole Bible. I mean, Paul had so many corrective things to say to the church in Corinth. And his next letter to them, the second chapter, or second book of Corinthians, chapter 11, he says, look, I took wages from other churches, but I didn't from you. And you know what? Maybe that was wrong. Maybe that wasn't such a good idea. It might have been wrong. That's the other point I take from this. It might have been wrong for me not to do that. Why would it have been wrong? Well, obviously, it led to some false claims that he wasn't really an apostle. That's what he was defending himself against, that he wasn't really a minister. He really wasn't an apostle of Christ. And he said, maybe that was wrong of me to not do that. It led to some wrong conclusions in the minds of the members there. So So, as I said, maybe there are more points. Those are the ones that kind of stand out in my mind. The point being, the ministry in the New Testament era has the right from God to live of the tithes, to be responsible for and to oversee the spending of the tithes, for the expenses that are incurred to take care of congregations, to preach the gospel. Those two aspects of the commission the church was given: preach the gospel and care for those God calls. And the New Testament ministry has the responsibility to do that. So, in my mind, quickly going through these passages makes it very clear that God still looks at tithing as a commandment. It is a command from Him. It's His intent for the way His servants are to be supported for doing His work. God still claims that first tenth of our income and gives it to His servants today to do His work, to preach the gospel and to care for the church. Now, as all of us know, there are a number of Church of God fellowships around us today, not just one. And that does tend to make things a bit confusing in the 21st century. There are a number of self-proclaimed leaders and ministers, individuals who claim to have special positions. And while I have no question in my mind that that's not really what God prefers, God has allowed it. God allows that to take place. And maybe that's a test for us to see how we respond to that. But tithing is a command of God, and it's something that we must teach if we're going to be honest with Scripture. There's one final area I want to discuss about finances and tithing today. I'd like to discuss quickly the topic of multiple tithes. Up to this point, everything we've been discussing is obviously that first tithe that God claims for doing His work, for preaching the gospel, for caring for those that God calls, and for continuing to educate and to teach them. That's a responsibility that we have as the church as a whole and as the ministry. We read in Leviticus 27, Numbers 18, God says it's His tithe. That belongs to Him. And He gave it to Levi in the Old Testament. He gave it to the ministry in the New Testament, in the New Covenant. But there's more in the way of tithing than simply that first tithe. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 14. Again, a passage that's familiar to many of us who've been in God's church for a number of decades. Deuteronomy chapter 14. In verse 22, Deuteronomy 14, 22 says, "You shall truly tithe." And he didn't have to put the word truly in there, but he did. This is something you should be careful about doing regularly. "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where He chooses to make His name abide, the tithe of your grain, of your new wine, of your oil, of the firstborn of your herds, of your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. But if the journey is too long, if you're not able to carry the tithe, or if the place where the Lord chooses to put His name is too far from you when the Lord has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money, take the money in your hand, and go to the place the Lord your God chooses. And you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen and sheep, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household." That's very obviously talking about the festivals where God has placed His name to observe His feast. This tithe, he says, is something you do every year, truly tithe every year of the increase, and you eat this before God in the place that He sets His name. So this is a festival tithe. This is a tithe that God uses to establish a means of financing us going to His feast. Again, He commands it. He commands that we save that, and then He gives it to us at His feasts or for keeping His festivals. So faithfully keeping a second tithe is another way that we show reverence to God. It's another way of showing respect to Him, of following His instructions. Now, in Deuteronomy 14, the last couple of verses, it says this: "At the end of every third year, You shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. And the Levite, because he has no portion nor inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates may come and eat and be satisfied, that your Lord your God may bless you and all the work of your hand which you do. So this tithe is only in the third year. It is a tithe for the needy. So we have the first tithe for doing God's work. We have a festival tithe that God gives to each of us to be able to keep his feasts. And then we have in the third year, as it says here, a tithe for assistance. A tithe of that year. So you don't count up all the previous years. It's only in that year that you take a third tithe or an assistance tithe, and you bring that for those who are needy. Now, if it was the same as the second tithe, as some people try to claim, how would you attend the feast? If you were to give that for the Levites and the needy, how would you keep the feast? Well, you wouldn't have any means of keeping it. So this is obviously a separate, different tithe. Some people have said, well, God promised a bountiful harvest in the sixth year, so you could eat of it and carry over into the next year. He never says that about the third year, does he? So this is not the same tithe as the festival tithe. It is a separate tithe. Here in Deuteronomy 26, we find another statement about this tithe that is to assist those who are needy. The fatherless, the poor, the widow. Deuteronomy chapter 26, and we can start in verse 12. It says, when you have finished laying aside all the tithe of your increase of the third year, the year of tithing. So this was a special year in which a tithe was kept, unlike the tithes of every other year, first tithe and festival tithe. But in this year, the year of tithing, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so they may eat within your gates and be filled, then you shall say before the Lord your God, I have removed the holy tithe from my house. I have given them to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandments which you have commanded me. I have not transgressed your commandments, nor have I forgotten them. So this is a holy tithe. It is a separate tithe. It is a tithe that is sanctified, set apart for a special use. This tithe is for those who are needy, those who have lack, the fatherless, the stranger, and the widow. Remember Deuteronomy 14 said the third year. Well, Leviticus 27 describes a seven-year cycle, a third year and a sixth year, and then the seventh year when they didn't plant and therefore wouldn't have crops to tithe on. And so what we understand from this was that in the third year and the sixth year, they would give this third tithe, this assistance tithe. And then the seventh year would be a year of release, and the cycle would start over again. Now, there are many sources outside the Bible that confirm that there was more than one tithe. This really tells us that there were. Some years back, I shared a PowerPoint presentation about tithing, and I listed out 18 different extra-biblical, outside-the-Bible sources that all talk about multiple tithes, that there's not just one, but there were multiple tithes that God established in the Old Testament. I brought two books with me today. One of them is the book of Josephus. Josephus was a Jewish historian. He lived around the time of Christ. And in his book, Antiquities of the Jews, in chapter 4, actually, book 4, chapter 8, section 8, says here, let there be taken out of your fruits a tenth, besides that which you have allotted to give to the priests and the Levites. This you may indeed sell in the country, but it is to be used in those feasts and sacrifices which are to be celebrated in the holy city. For it is fit that you should enjoy those fruits of the earth which God gives you to possess, so as may be to the honor of the donor. So Josephus says there is this festival tithe. It's in addition to the first tithe that you give to the Levites. A little bit later, same book, same chapter, but section 22, he says, besides these two tithes, which I have already said you are to pay every year, the one for the Levites, the other for the festivals, you are to bring every third year a third tithe to be distributed to those that want, to women also who are widows and to children that are orphans. So Josephus very specifically says this was the practice in the first century when he lived. The other book that I brought is a Bible. It just so happens this Bible has more than the books of the Bible. It has the Apocrypha, which is not recognized as inspired. But the book of Tobit, which is a historical book, scholars date Tobit's life to around the 200 BC time period, a couple hundred years before Christ. We look at it as historical, not scriptural, but it is historical. So if we use this as another outside the Bible source, so forget the fact that it is inside this Bible. We don't recognize it as scripture. But look what Tobit says. This is in the first part of this book, verses 6 to 8. He says, "But I alone went often to Jerusalem for the festivals, as it is prescribed for all Israel by an everlasting decree. I would hurry off to Jerusalem with the first fruits of the crops and the firstlings of the flocks, the tithe of the cattle, and the first shearings of the sheep. I would give these to the priests, the sons of Aaron, at the altar. Likewise, the tenth of the grain, wine, olive oil, pomegranates, figs, and the rest of the fruits to the sons of Levi who ministered to Jerusalem. Also, for 6 years, I would save up a second tenth in money and go to distribute it in Jerusalem. A third tenth I would give to the orphans and widows and to the converts who had attached themselves to Israel. I would bring it and give it to them in the third year. And we would eat it according to the ordinance decreed concerning it in the law of Moses, according to the instructions of Deborah, the mother of my father, the Tobiah, for my father had died and left me an orphan." So Tobit mentions three distinct tithes as well. Now, as I said, there are many other passages. I think Scripture is clear on it, but sometimes those outside sources just help confirm that this is what was understood, this is what was practiced in the days of Christ. Now, what difference does all of that make? Well, it does make a difference because there are some groups who say that the second tithe is done away, that you don't need to keep a second tithe, much less a third tithe. And that would excuse them from needing to go anywhere for the feast. You simply would keep it at home. Now, I'm not saying that's derogatory. I'm not trying to say that in a derogatory way. It just seems to me a logical way of saying, well, we don't need a second tithe because we're not going anywhere to keep the feast, even though God says we're to do that. So very, very important that we do recognize God does say those two tithes, the one for doing his work and the one for keeping the feasts, are required every year. Quick comment about third tithe. Final point I want to make on that one is this. As was the case in our former organization, we believe that God does not require us and doesn't require members to pay what would be in essence a duplication of third tithe. What do I mean by that? Well, in 1982, when Mr. Armstrong was presented some facts about taxation in various nations and how much people were paying in the way of taxes and how they struggled to survive by tithing and paying those taxes and paying a third tithe every third year, 2 years out of seven, the third and the sixth, when many of those taxes were going to do the exact thing that the third tithe is designed to do, to take care of widows, to take care of the needy, to take care of orphans, to help people who are disadvantaged or who, for no fault of their own, have ended up in need. The administrative decision was made that members in that situation would not need to pay third tithe in addition to paying taxes that would equate to a third tithe. That remained the case and eventually became the principle in every nation where the church had members except the United States. And some years back, as our nation has continued to move more and more toward a socialistic approach to life of caring more and more and providing more and more social benefits, it was decided that we ought to apply this to the U.S. just like we do every other nation in the world. and that people would not be required to keep what in essence would be two-third tithes. And we don't discourage people who, out of their desire to provide for and to help the needy, choose to continue to pay third tithe, keep it up every third and sixth year, or some do it by paying basically approximately 3% every year. If you figure out the math over a seven-year period and you pay 3% for those full 7 years, it works out to being the 10% paid twice during that seven-year cycle. But we don't dissuade people from doing that as long as it doesn't put them in a position where they have to turn around and ask for help from the church for basic needs. I mean, that would be, it wouldn't be wise, would it? So just as a word to explanation of our approach to third tithe. Yes, it is important. Yes, God does want to take care of the needy. Our government is taking more and more care of needy people, but we realize it's not perfect, and sometimes people need more than what the government will make available. And so we see our responsibility as a church to still help people who have needs. As we've seen today, tithing has and continues to be the method by which God finances his work and the method by which he takes care of us attending the feast, and he wants to take care of the needy people. The book of Proverbs has a good summary passage on this topic. It's addressed to young people, but it's available to all of us. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3. I've waited to the end to give you the title of this message. You've got to do things different every now and then, right? Proverbs chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. Says, honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase, so that your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. When we follow God's instructions and we show him honor, when we follow any of his instructions, we show him honor. But when we do it by following his instructions about our physical possessions, we show him honor as well. When we do that, we are blessed. Obviously, we should show God honor with our not only our material blessings, but with everything we do in life. We ought to honor him. We ought to show him honor and respect. But with material possessions, it is important as well. Tithing is honoring God with our substance. It is showing that honor to him. As with all of God's commands, we're blessed if we obey them, and we suffer consequences if we don't. We do not obey, and we end up paying some consequences. I'd like to end by reading Malachi 3. I referenced it earlier but didn't turn there. But let's turn to Malachi chapter 3 and see what God says. The statement he makes through the prophet Malachi. In verse 8, he says, will a man rob God? Malachi 3, verse 8, yet you have robbed me, but you say, in what way have we robbed you? And the response of God is this, in tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts. If I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. God challenged the people in the days of Malachi, and he challenges us. He challenges his people through all time periods, today as well, to obey and reap the blessings from doing so. Notice he doesn't say, disobey and see if I don't curse you. Doesn't say that. He says, obey. Just do it. See if it doesn't be ultimately for your benefit. See if it doesn't benefit you. His challenge applies to us just as much as it did to ancient Israel.